Hi, everybody.
You're the engine that makes all things go, and you're always in disguise, my hero. I see your light in the dark, smile in my face when we all know it's hard. There's no way to ever pay you back. Bless your heart, no, I love you for that. Honest and selfless, I don't know if this helps it, but good job. You're doing a good job, a good job. You're doing a good job, don't get too down. The world needs you now, know that you matter.
Welcome back to Pearls of Wisdom. This is Melissa Peskin. Nice to see you or hear from you again. I'm so excited because in contrast to previous episodes, I actually have people whose attending I was, as opposed to the people who I was a baby resident with. So we're going to hear a little bit of a different perspective. I actually truly love these three. So I'm going to let you introduce yourselves and then tell me like when you did residency, where you are now, and we'll just like go from there. How's that sound? Michelle, you want to start?
Sure.
You're at the top of the screen.
So I am Michelle Cappy. I did residency both with Rubel and Ariel from 2018 to 2022 at Montefiore. And after leaving Montefiore, I did a 3-year fellowship in REI, reproductive endocrinology and infertility at Columbia. And now I'm 2 weeks into being an attending at a private fertility practice in Manhattan.
Woo! Congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's still through, judging on your background, that's still through Columbia?
It's not. I just haven't changed my Zoom background.
Ouch. Okay.
Yes. No, no. It's at Spring Fertility. It's
wow. Fancy.
Lovely and welcoming. And it's great so far.
I feel like that was in your cards. But, you know, having gone through Montefiore, we'll see how that influenced you. Okay, Ariel, you're up.
Hi, I'm Ariel Catcher. That is the first time I've ever heard Cappy call me by my first name ever, I think. yeah, it was weird. I also did residency at Montefiore. I'm a year ahead of Rupal and Cappy, so I was there from 2017 to 2021. Following residency, I did a GYN oncology fellowship at Northwell. And I'm now a year into being an attending at Christiana Care in Delaware. We are the only gynoc division in our state. So
ooh, busy.
Much different world than New York. Yeah. Yeah.
Exciting. Congratulations. I can't believe you guys finished fellowship.
It's crazy.
Time just
me neither.
like residency is just like a revolving door of doctors. And I've lost track of who and when. I will say I have like people I remember, which is why you're here, and people I don't. So that's the cold, hard truth. So Rupal.
My name is Rupal Bana. I was, as we've said multiple times now, co-residents with the other two. I was in the same class as Cappy, Michelle Cappy. In 2022, from when were we resident? 2022, and then I did my fellowship at Montefiore for GYN oncology fellowship, and I'm 3 weeks in to being an attending at NYU Long Island with Melissa Peskin.
Yes.
And
yes.
This is my first weekend on call. So.
Actually, this is the first time, second time I'm seeing your pretty face. That's awesome. I'm super excited to have you.
We're happy to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of what we've sort of previously talked about is, you know, like your, you know, most memorable experiences from residency. But I think I'm curious because, you know, you all three have now in your attendings, and you are sort of very, very new attendings. I would say you're still even out of fellowship. See, these are really smart people. I didn't do fellowship, but that's okay. I'm going to feel like I'm also kind of smart, but maybe not as smart as you. So you did fellowship, but now you're a junior attending. So what is that like? Like, how does that feel right now? Like, scary, exciting? I don't know.
I mean, I've only been doing it for 3 weeks. I think Ariel is probably the best one to answer that. But honestly, I'm kind of losing it a little bit. Like every five, like the easiest things, and it's not clinical. Like I haven't had any clinical issues so far. It's 3 weeks, so say that with a grain of salt. But it's like, I don't know how to bill. I don't know how to do like, oh, do these patients get accepted to our service or do they go some like to a different service, because I'm used to the Monty way, where if someone's toothaches, they get admitted to G1 oncology because they had cancer in 2002. And
that's do how that. That's, you know, how, what? Rupal, do that.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's good. They might get kicked off the service next week, but like while you're here, we're really happy about that.
Yeah. So that, those kinds of things are things that I'm like trying to figure out, like, what is the culture here? You don't want to like go change a culture once, like the second you get somewhere, you want to understand like how they do things. So before you, you know, kind of put your mark on it, like maybe they do things way better in some areas, and I'm sure they do. And it's good to learn those things before you kind of like say, I should manage a dental emergency.
Yeah. Like Ariel, how's it been? It's been a year, right?
Yeah. It's been a whole year. I'm, you know, at 1 year, all my problems magically resolve themselves. It's no longer hard to be an attending, and I've just got it all figured out. I'm like totally kidding, obviously. it is like both like the like best and the worst thing at times. Like, you know, I think when you're in training, you're like moving toward this goal and it seems so unattainable at times, and you're like, am I ever going to survive? And then you do it and you get there and you're like, you know, you're like, you've arrived at like the thing that you've been trying to achieve for decades, which is great and amazing. It's fun to be an attending in a lot of ways, but it's also that transition of like, there is no safety net. You know, I'm very lucky. I work with, a senior partner, and my third partner is starting actually this week. Nice. Who's very supportive and he's very great to work with. But it is like, it is a big transition, you know, probably my second or third week into being attending, I got called into an operating room to help someone who's like many years senior to me. And they're like, can you help me get out of this mess? And I was like, I don't know, I guess we'll find out. And we did, and it was okay, but it is, that part's a little bit crazy. I think the thing that's really wild, we don't have fellows where I work. We have wonderful residents. And they like look at me like I know everything. And I remember looking at my attendings like that. And like, now I'm kind of like, yeah, no, like I know a lot, you know, I've studied and trained a lot, but there are things that, you know, you realize maybe some of those times where your attending was acting like they knew everything, maybe they did not, but they were going to figure it out and teach you about it and you would learn and it would be great. So there's that part.
Do you remember one of those times in residency where it happened to you?
I remember having a patient, actually an onc patient. I won't say who the attending was, but I remember having a patient who had like something really crazy happening on their labs, like just very weird electrolyte derangements. And I remember something in the back of my head, like was dinging, like this is something that you learned in med school, but you haven't seen since. And I remember looking it up and I, you know, now it's like all gone, but I felt like I know everything because I looked this up and I knew, and I said it on rounds and it was like, okay, sounds great. Like, go ahead and replete her electrolytes. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, sounds good. And they acted like they knew. I ran into that person at an SGO later and they're like, I have no idea what that is. I never knew. And I still remember you said that. And I was like, that girl is like a nerd, you know, just like, I
go catcher.
So to this day, I think about that moment. And when like residents ask me, like, I'm very, you know, I'll be like, I'm not 100% sure, but we'll look it up or we'll figure it out. Or, you know, there's a lot of gray area in medicine. And when you're the trainee, the gray area is like the part you deal with. The person that makes it black and white is the attending, you know? So now you get to do that. And that's like fun, scary, challenging, but in a good way.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy being an attending. It's my main consensus.
Yeah, I always remembered like this, like feeling like, you know, you can always like look behind you and there's someone there. And then all of a sudden you look behind you and then there's no one there. Like you're it. And that's, yeah. You know, that's how I feel like with shoulder dystocia, you know, I just, mm-hmm. I mean, you guys don't do that anymore,
but you're the God. Last line.
Thank
of defense.
God.
God.
Yeah. Oof.
I've had my fair share.
Yeah. Getting called into an OR to help as like the end all surgical consultant. I think that was the first time where I was like, oh yeah, no, like this shit is real. But at the same time, it was like a really cool feeling to walk in and be like, I know exactly what I want to do. I know, like, I'm scared, but I know what to do. And like, you really fall back into that training. And I left and I texted my attendings from fellowship being like, guess what I just did? And they were like, welcome to the club, honey. Like, you know, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't realize until you get out here. And I think I talked to you guys a lot about that, like life after residency situation, but you know, that feeling of pride when you get to tell your mentors that you handled something, you know, I remember, I don't know. I texted Dudek that I forget, like a twin vaginal delivery, yeah. Something like really hard, where it was like nuchal arms and stuff. And I was like, oh, he's the first person I want to tell, you know, well, I texted him. And
section, oh. There's like nothing like that.
Right?
There's nothing like a dude.
It's like, okay, here. And you're like, wow, I've never seen it just come together so fast and easy. He's like,
oh, I miss him.
It's like, yeah. Like excluding you, Peskin, it's like the pantheon for, at least for us, or me rather, is like Ty, Dudek, and George Dulaveris. Like those are the three people I want. I would go out of retirement and do a C-section with them.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fun. I remember doing a C-section with Dudek, and I hadn't, you know, in your third year, remember at Einstein, you don't really operate at all, right? So yeah. I remember it being like the end of the third year, and I went into a section, and I just hadn't, I don't know, I just like my hands weren't there. And I'll never forget, he goes, so you'll tie the next one. And I was like, I think I had just taken like two or three like throws, and I was like, okay, sure, I'll tie the next one. Yeah, okay, ouch. That hurt a lot. Yeah, he didn't mess around. He just like wanted to get in and get out. And
right.
But yeah, it's when so you
and huh? he taught us a lot. I feel
yeah,
like
he did.
He was a really calm, and there were definitely a handful of those that were really just level-headed, really intelligent people that we had there.
Totally.
And just so good. Mm-hmm. Calm, good. Normal.
Are you remembering the same residency?
Okay. I said a handful.
Because like,
yeah, some, not all.
Okay,
not all, but
the ones we were just talking about, for sure.
I do feel like most of our attendings were calm, actually.
Okay.
At least it felt like that to me. I didn't feel like, I mean, we did have some odd, more eccentric personalities, but. I don't feel like I felt that way about most of them. I thought most people were like actually like normal, easy.
Also think that, at least I can speak for the three of us, are not frantic,
yeah,
very stressed humans. So I think that that probably helps too, to not have multiple stressed, frantic people on call together, because otherwise it can just be a hodgepodge.
I think also we like this three people here also like kind of can calm an attending. We were like friends with our attendings too, you know, and we could be like, hey, just chill out, it'll be okay, like we'll figure okay. It out together, yeah. You know,
let
it'll
me hold your hand,
yeah, like it'll be okay, you know.
So, I also think that, like, I don't know, I training in two different places, seeing how other people do stuff. Obviously, I wasn't on the labor floor a lot as a fellow, but I was there more than I would have liked to be. And I saw things that I was like, yeah, this is not the way that I would have done it in residency, but I'm just going to stand here and just, I'm just here as a mechanic, you know, like I'm here for my role and I should mind my own business. But I'm like, oh, interessante, very interessante.
Having been in like multiple hospitals, I really come back to that, especially the Weiler labor floor specifically, as being sort of the gold standard in a lot of ways. I mean, maybe not every, you know, maybe not the system stuff, but I really, I think about it over and over, and I watch other physicians and how we manage stuff, and my initial reaction to things, and have come to understand that the acuity and the complications that we regularly routinely saw were managed for the most part probably really well medically, and then trained us sort of superbly, because, you know, I mean, I don't know, whatever you think about me, I feel like I've had an incredible training, and I've been told that I'm really well trained, and my first reaction when I'm in any environment is sort of thinking about how to anticipating to put out all the fires and prevent all of the bad things. And people often look at me like I have like two or three heads, right? Like, why would you say that? Why do you think that the worst is going to happen? And I'm like, because it could, and I'm going to try to be prepared in the event that that does, and, you know,
it has happened.
It has, and it will at some point.
If
it
that
will,
was the right? case, people would deliver in their house, right? The reason you're in the hospital is because you're banking that I might need a medical intervention, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't deliver in the hospital.
But so, I agree.
You wouldn't have surgery in the hospital. You wouldn't do anything in a hospital.
Yeah, like, that's just, the like, whole point out. Is to be prepared for whatever.
I think that. For sure, the Weiler labor floor, I agree with you, the gold standard of preparing everyone, even if you didn't want to be prepared, that changed you as a human. And look, there's not that many emergencies in my field on a day-to-day basis. Yes, you could have an ectopic, etc. But from being in residency and being on that labor floor, it has taught me all the time to be fully prepared for anything. And when an emergency comes up, when other people are frantic and not knowing how to deal with it, I think that I've been so well prepared to deal with something that comes up because of that.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a lot, right? Like it got beat into you, but you, I mean, yeah. I mean, Rupa, you're going to discover at NYU that they are not used to that.
I have gathered. You can't, right? If the volume, like you, it, I would not, I'm not commenting on the ability, competency, any of that. Like, I've not seen that at all. Like, I've only been here for 3 weeks. But I have seen the volume just peripherally. And I can say, like, there are only so many emergencies that can happen when there's only that many people there, you know? Whereas I think we were used to, if there was one emergency going on at any given moment in time, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's like, oh, I only have to deal with one massive problem. There's only one shoulder going on. That's fine. Like, there's, but we would be used to a shoulder in one room and a hemorrhage in another room, and both attendings are in the back in complicated sections. And you're like, okay, I will figure it out. Like, I will fix, and there's eight other patients in labor. Half of them have preeclampsia. There's multiple patients downstairs with other issues that you're monitoring. And then there's an ectopic that came through the ED and your second year is gone. So like, that was a literally every 2 or 3 day occurrence. And then you would get through those 2 hours of that problem, and then you would only have one emergency at a time, and you're like, oh well, night was fine. Like, here's,
well, it's refreshing to hear you say that and to have the others nod, because people don't believe me.
No, so, totally, yeah. It is. We would do like 7 sections in a, like one individual would do 6 or 7 sections in a, like, that wasn't super common, but we would do, you know, a lot. Like, you wouldn't leave the OR. And Dr. Tai, again, she'll be like, I'll do it. I'll do it. She would just, like, go back. It was a revolving door, you know? I remember that so many times. She's talked
to me. I remember just, like, walking between rooms.
Oh, yeah. They would prep like, you would one go room.
From one room, and they would prep the other, and you would just come assist, and you'd be, like, you'd be reading the chart in between. You'd eat
the intern would be
like
rolling
a Diet Shasta and a graham cracker, and you went, like, you just, you know, you guys, change you mask, guys, Shasta, and go.
Do you guys know that, so when I was a resident, they had the kitchen was still kosher, but it was, like, really yummy food, okay? They had, like, fried chicken and real steak fries, like, fatty food, and then one day, somebody came in and was like, this is unhealthy. So we have to, like, make everything grilled, and you can no longer have steak fries. You have to have tater tots, and you can no longer have regular Shasta, because this is now the second time that a group has talked about the Shasta and on this podcast. And it used to be
the most famous part of residency in Montefiore twice.
I've eaten. Okay. The only thing I ever ate at Montefiore was those, they make these, fried dough balls on Fridays. That's all I know. Like, that's the only thing I ate at Monte.
I don't remember fried dough balls.
Yeah, they remember fish. Maybe it was only during my fellowship. I can't remember.
I feel like that's a new thing.
Yeah, that was. They didn't have fried dough balls. No. Yeah.
The making guy they just had those fried, like, dough. Like, it's literally just dough.
Yeah, they had those, like, questionable hot dogs. I remember taking, like, milk off of, like, the patient trays. Like, they were in the hallway and they hadn't been served yet. Like, taking milk off of that, like, for coffee.
That's like, all you did? That's called raccooning. Like, so, Justin Toe. Do you know who Justin Toe is?
No.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Justin Toe. Yeah. So, he defined that. So, he used to eat the trays, and then he called it raccooning. And then the rest of us just did that. Because, like, when I was a resident, we didn't order like you did. We didn't. I mean, I don't know whether it was we just didn't, or we didn't have any money, or we waited for the, I don't know, but we just ate off the patient trays, and we would go down to the caf and get drinks and, like, come up and, like, cause we would use our food cards to get drinks. And so somebody would go down and, like, stock up on waters and diet soda or whatever. And then, and the Snapple, and that was it. And then we
would eat off leftover food.
Well, not leftover food, but, like, you know, they
it was like a trays for fresh the tray.
No, okay. These are all empty. Oh,
the garbage. Like,
that is crazy.
Yeah. Like, raccooning in the sense that they were in a dumpster getting the food.
Yeah. Raccooning.
We definitely ate from that, the little calf when you walked in. Like, the cheese, grapes, and crackers was a staple.
Oh, that's the only thing.
Uncrustables. Yeah. They had Uncrustables,
coffee,
I think.
And that
I remember when I was interviewing for residency, I, like, had, you know, you do your pro con list or whatever it was to, like, try and help you decide where you want to go to residency. Not that you ever really had much choice in the matter. Those things happen at another level. but I remember, like, being like, I don't think I want to go there because the food is so bad. Like, I don't know. I can't work in a place where that food is that bad, but here we are. And I still gained weight.
And you were there for
seven years.
Yeah, 7 years. Right,
and
right.
You never left because of the fried dough balls. And
can we just be honest that the worst week in the entire hospital was Passover? Like, I mean, you guys didn't eat in the cafeteria, but
I didn't,
like,
eat there. It didn't make a difference.
Yeah, but it was like, I would actually plan my vacations around that week because I didn't want to be.
Not because you're Jewish, but because.
No, because I didn't want to be in the hospital.
That's
the eggs were like this, like from a, like powdered eggs from a carton, like like kosher for Passover. Yeah. Anyway,
good times.
Yeah. So what is, Cappy, you haven't said much. So what is your most memorable thing you think?
Oof. From.
Yeah.
Well, I would say similar to there just always being emergency. I remember a night, I think I was on, I just remember being on with Dr. Levy, who was such a good person to be on with. I got a call. It must've been the beginning of, the year. So the interns and second years were new-ish, maybe the first 2 months. And I got a call from my second year who evaluated someone in triage. And she was having, you know, obese and was having she was maybe 28 weeks pregnant. She was having an asthma attack, but severe asthma attack. I had to go also evaluate her. She had to get intubated. The baby was down. A million things were happening on the labor floor. This is when triage is bumping. So we're also making this triage in one of the postpartum rooms. You know how we would do that sometimes? Okay. So I remember.
That's not good. Like, that's not
good. Not good.
We had to take her to. Yeah, I think that we actually passed her off to maybe you came on next. So we then had to bring her while we're intubating her to the main OR because the fetal heart tracing, the baby was down. We can't get her in the door of the OR. It was a postpartum bed. There was something either like the door was not opening. This is like, you know, so many Swiss cheese model. You could go through all of the issues of this, but so we couldn't get her through the door of the OR. So I remember straddling the bed and doing a C-section in the doorway.
Wait, what? I don't know this case.
C-section. We were literally not fully in the OR, but she was being intubated. The baby was down. We couldn't get into the OR, and it was wild. We threw the prep on her, and I just was like literally straddling this woman, and we got the baby out. And she was fine and the baby was fine. And I just remember, like, after the baby was out, suturing her up, it's like, okay, should we go into the OR now? Like,
thank God.
To do this.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
But this is a classic situation too, yeah, where even on the hardest days, the sense of community that we had was one of the most rewarding parts of being there. The bonds that you had with the nurses, the OR techs, residents, the attendings, they were unlike anything else. So we were all in it together, facing challenges side by side, supporting each other through tough cases. And then you also celebrated your victories together. And that was that kind of shared experience was so formative. And so I have a deep respect for all the people we worked with, and those connections are what I think about.
Oh, yeah. That's so nice.
Yeah. It all turned out okay.
It always did, you know, like, yeah, that's somehow the thing. Those crazy things always worked out because everyone was like pretty creative, like, and was like, this is what we got, we have to figure it out, this is like the way we're gonna MacGyver this situation, right? Like, I had done more Jacobi rings for Bartholin glands than I had ever done word catheters because we didn't have word catheters, right. So I only knew how to do a Jacobi ring by my fourth year. I was like, never put in a word catheter, like, I've only done this more complicated kind of weird thing because it's all we had, you know, like.
That's so funny. I did a sim for Bartholin's and stuff, and I taught everybody the Jacobi ring.
Yeah.
And they're like, why do we need to use this? We have word catheters. I was like, well, this is a very
rare. So you don't. Right. I used to carry one around in my bag. Like, I had one, like, in
a word?
Bag. Yeah.
Along with,
like,
the
if you found one,
along
I would,
with
like,
Mizo.
Keep it.
Yeah, so they much
were so hard. I would keep it in my bag, and I would have one, like, no matter which hospital I went to, I had one word catheter. Just in case.
That's genius, actually.
Yeah.
That's really smart.
What else did you have in your pack? I definitely have Misoprostol.
I still have so much lube. Do you know how much lube has gone through washers and dryers at my hand? Because it's just like in my pockets all the time.
In your pockets.
For personal use, for like professional.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah. No, like Miso Lube, word catheters. What else? As a
An
fellow, I used to
endometrial
do some.
biopsy, Pipel.
Oh yeah, biopsy Pipel.
That's a good
I
one.
Had that in there. Yeah, everything. You never knew.
You never knew.
Definitely around Jacoby, having a ring forceps would serve you well.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, but also Jacoby used to have, Ariel like sent this picture to everyone I'll never forget, where she, there was a pigeon in the hospital. Like
the pigeons.
There's just
oh,
like birds.
Oh my God.
In
I still have it. I still sometimes like scroll through to find that picture just to remind myself, like, that was not a fever dream. That was a real life thing that happened.
Well,
tell me.
We used to sleep in, well, you tell her about the pigeon.
Well, okay. So we had at Jacoby, we had a GYN, like the OBGYN resident room. And then we also had a call room, like upstairs, like in this really shady hall where you would sleep at night when you were the third year. And there was like the cockroach that lived in there. And
multiple.
Then in the basement though, was like the workroom. Okay. And I was leaving Jacoby after another super special day there. And I'm walking out and there's these vending machines in the hall. This is indoors in the basement of the hospital, inside.
Yeah,
there's no
I know.
Doors. You can't
right.
go in and out there. And I look over and there's two pigeons roosting on top of the vending machine. And I'm like, the fuck is going on in here? Like two live pigeons. And I'm walking around, like, I don't see anyone because you're in the basement. Like, you could easily get murdered in that basement. One of my senior residents used to barricade the door when she was down there alone because she was afraid she was going to get murdered in that room. I'll never forget. Anyway, you'd have to text her and tell her you were coming in the morning to pre-round as the intern because she'd be like barricaded in there. But I'm like walking out and I'm like, there's pigeons. And I remember like texting whatever PA we were with that day, being like, you got to go look, there's pigeons. She's like, oh yeah, they're like, they just live there. I'm like, this is strange that this is like a normal thing.
That's not the only wildlife in the Jacoby basement, actually, because I remember that, like, when I was a, maybe it was when I was a fellow, I can't remember, but there was, the PAs had their room in the basement too, but they had a, like a toilet in theirs. But a rat was coming through the toilet and they had like had all this rat poop in their like room or whatever.
No.
And then they realized it was coming from the toilet and they boarded up the toilet, like, so that, you know, it couldn't use the pipes or whatever, and it chewed through the wood and there was like a rat on the loose in Jacoby.
That's awful.
Those Jacoby rats.
But
those
again,
Jacoby
this
rats
is like not like
different.
Inpatient floors or anything. This is like the.
Okay.
Yeah, like this like weird annex that we worked
yeah, this
in
is
because
like,
that was like the most
I
suitable
actually don't
place
think
for us to
Jacoby was
work.
like unclean, like medically, but it was unclean in the basement.
Yeah, no, the
yeah, where
basement
we
was
were
definitely
was bad.
Sketchy. The basement was very
Yeah.
sketchy. I do remember that very clearly. So, but you guys.
It was like turn right morgue, turn left OBGYN workroom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there was an actual hallway where you had to make
no, the
that
morgue.
Choice. You went to the
Yeah.
morgue
Yeah.
or you went to where we worked.
But
and every day you'd be like, which way am I gonna go today? You know?
I definitely passed people under sheets for sure. On my way
no,
to the,
all the time.
All
they would keep
the
them
time.
Out there in the hall.
Yeah.
Ready
yeah.
to go for the next.
So do you guys remember, do you guys know who Tal Flegelman is? Did you remember him? No, he left. Okay, so Tal is another one. He was actually Erica Levy's year. He's also really, really funny. But there is this amazing story with him. So he had to round on this woman who was supposed to get a hysterectomy. So she was from, I want to say, Cuba, and she was Santeria. And she did not want a hysterectomy. And they, I think she was like, she, it was really indicated, whatever. And they finally like convinced her to do that. And the morning before the surgery, Tal went to go round on her. And he was really confused because there were like chicken feathers strewn throughout her bed and the bathroom. And apparently she had sacrificed a chicken in her room the morning or the night before surgery.
Fantastic.
That happened at Chicago.
And then everyone's like, okay, here's your consent form.
And the surgery went great. And the surgery went great. So who's the real schmuck here?
Well, okay. I mean, listen.
Did she eat it? Was she NPO? Like,
did she eat it? I don't think she ate it. I don't think that was the point. I think it was very spiritual.
Like a ceremony.
But it must have been why the surgery went really well. I don't know.
Yeah.
So
I just like, I think that's the other, like, the like being prepared for all emergencies thing, like, yeah, like everything was crazy always, all the time. Like I have, like, just hearing other you guys tell stories, like I'm like, oh, that reminds me of 10 me other
yeah
wild I things that, have that. Happened. Like,
there's four other things that happened.
But like the also that, like, nothing really surprises me. Like it really does take a lot for me to be like, well, haven't seen that before, because like I do feel like the things that I saw, did, experienced, I'm like, now I'm like, it's going to take a lot. And like, I do feel like that has been my reputation since leaving residency, like as a fellow and now as an attending, like people will be like, isn't that wild? And I'm like, no, that's, you're going to have to try harder than that. You know what I mean? Like, and so now when I get like, I'm like, whoa, like people are like, uh-oh, like something's
it's real.
That's surprising. Yeah. Because my tolerance is just so high, which I think is also a good thing, because it just allows you to like get past all that stuff. Like I've had some really, really socially complex patients as a new attending, and I don't get frazzled by it or like stuck on it. I'm like, all right, no problem, we'll deal with that. But like right now we got to deal with this, because you also have cancer on top of those other 100 things that you told me about. And yes, we're going to coordinate giving you radiation and chemo while you're coming in and out of prison. And like, that's not going to be a problem, because like, I've done that before, you know? So that I'm very grateful for. I don't know, like when you're in the moment, you can be so grateful for it, because you're just like, why is nothing normal? And why is everything hard? But now with perspective, I feel like it's easy to cope. And I do think, I mean, like, it's going to come up. We are like the COVID generation.
I'll never forget you in a COVID. You were on the labor floor with me that month. I was there like the 24 on or something, 36 off, something like that. And I actually have a lot of pictures of you in all of our makeshift garb, you know, like actually.
Yeah, like a Yankees poncho and ski goggles. That was particularly fun.
Every day there was like a new ski goggle. So was that your, do you think that was your hardest part of residency?
I mean, yeah, I like, it was like hard in the sense, I think the hardest part of COVID was the part where I was like, am I going to also die? Like the patient care was hard and it was emotionally very taxing. I don't think, like, again, like the things that happen, like all that, like you had to be in 12 places at once kind of went away during COVID, because people really weren't coming to the hospital. We were actually less busy. The labor floor was still crazy. The acuity was worse though. Every patient was so sick and everything was so stressful. I remember like, we were passing off a patient in the ICU who like kept faking us out in labor. And like, we would hand each other the scalpel. We had a scalpel like wrapped up and just keep it in your pocket. And we would hand off the scalpel when we would sign out the board. And it was just like, that part was crazy. But there was also the, like, you would hear like so-and-so's friend is a resident here and they're intubated in the ICU, and this person, you know, from med school actually died, and you were like, am I gonna also die on top of this? But I think the hardest part of COVID
right now, while COVID infection rates go down in other parts of the city, the infection rates in the Bronx actually is climbing.
Within New York City, you see the Bronx is high, 27%. Brooklyn 19, Manhattan 17, Queens 18, Staten Island 19. And we're going to do more research to understand what's going on there. Why is the Bronx higher than the other boroughs?
So you heard there, Governor Cuomo sounding the alarm right over the weekend. Well, this morning we are joined by Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. to discuss really how the COVID crisis is crippling his borough. Good morning to you, sir. It's twice as high as Manhattan. What do you think makes residents in the Bronx just more susceptible to the virus? Why are we seeing a higher caseload in the Bronx?
Well, I say it's for three reasons. And the first reason is because of the health disparity. This is not anything new, Dan. We've been talking about this for decades. We know that in certain parts of our borough, the health disparities are greater than many, not only parts of the city, but the state and the country. We've been trying to highlight these issues. We've been trying to get people quality health care. And whenever you get a pandemic, whenever you get something like COVID, a few years ago, we had Legionella. We know that those with pre-existing right. conditions are susceptible to being hurt the most. Number two is that those individuals in the Bronx who are working, many of them are essential workers. So they're putting their lives on the line. Many of them are the ones in the front line. They're EMS, they're in transportation, they're delivering. And this is not a joke. Our people are dying. In my borough alone, we have over 3,900 deaths.
But I think the hardest part of COVID was coming back. That was actually, to me, when the hospital was the scariest, because like we were having patient volume go up, but we were still not ready. Like there was that period of time where we still didn't really have like enough PPE rooms, equipment, but people were feeling safe to come back to the hospital. And I still will never forget, like I was most scared I'd ever been in all of residency as I saw a patient in the ER. Our ORs were still closed. You still had to get permission from whoever that guy was that, you know, whatever chief of whoever, whatever his name is that I never met and cared to never meet. And you'd have to call him and ask permission to take someone to the operating room because he was qualified to make that decision for every single patient that walked in the hospital, obviously, as whatever specialty he was. And this woman came to the ER with an incomplete abortion and she had, you know, stuff hanging out in her cervix. So I did what you're supposed to do, which is gently tease them out with some forceps. And when I've never seen bleeding like I saw, and my attending that was on was a MIGS fellow attending my former resident, Mona. And I called her and I said, you need to come down here. And she was like, when you called me, I ran because I knew something was bad. And she came to the room and I looked at her and I was like, I don't know. So we were trying to get this patient to the OR. We were trying to get her to the OR. We couldn't get in touch with this guy. The OR wouldn't let us come. We like didn't have any, like we were in the middle of the ER, in the back of the ER, you know, where they like annex women back there in that
yeah. room 19. Like yeah. That's where many 19. Women have tried to die. Yep.
Right. Cause that was the appropriate place to put them. And cause that's the only place you can fit an exam bed. And I remember like just being like, call everyone in the ER, go out to the red zone to the intern that was with me. I said, go out to the red zone where like all the attendants are. I said, just yell for help, just yell help. And then people came and everybody ran in and they're like, what do you need? And we were like, an OR, we need an OR. We couldn't get an OR. They wouldn't let us bring the patient up. They were like, not until you get permission. So we gave this patient like sedation in the ER. The ER attending was great. He was like, I'll set her up. We'll give her sedation. And we did a suction DNC because Erica Levy put that into place in our ER. And we like, you know, that's it was, amazing. It all worked out. The patient was fine. She lived, she was okay. Oh, but like, God. That was one of those times where I was like, how do you make it through all of COVID?
Right.
And then this is how it's going to be. Like, you're just going to be in this. And I don't know. I never felt like we were ever going to go back to normal. And we still haven't, really, totally. People are really messed up now, like in so many ways. But that was like the scary part to me.
That's horrible.
The, like coming back.
No, that's, I remember Rupal and I forever. Had... We were on call the same weekend at Moses when we got exposed and we were like patient zero. I was the first one in the residency.
I remember that. You guys were like the patient zero of the residency program.
Yeah, we both got COVID.
Like, if anyone has come in contact with Rupal or Michelle, please contact me. We were like, they've come in contact with everyone. They're the two most social people here.
We had it the same weekend and it was before it. People were even it's getting
before people knew. Yeah, there were tests.
We had to like get higher up permission to get tested for it, and then when we were at home, people, attendings and residents were texting us like, "Are you okay? Like, what do you need?" I just remember it was wild, and just the whole time, I think Patrick, we were on together. You had these pods of people.
All of us were at Weiler together. Yeah. We were the Weiler
together.
The people who are listening, hopefully not that one guy who complained, but for the people who are listening, like the way that our hospital tried to do it is like we would be in pods at the hospital. Like we would have a group of people who you would be like 4 days on and then four days on nights, and your same group would sign out to the same group. So if anybody had exposed, you didn't have an entire workforce of a whole residency that was exposed. So we all worked together. Like I remember Ariel and I would like sign out to each other every day.
I do remember that being a really, besides for it being a crazy time with some of the sickest patients, it was a super isolating time as a resident. Like I remember being more sad on the days when I wasn't at work because the only people I saw were at work. It was a war zone. You could walk in the streets of Manhattan in the middle of the day and there wouldn't be cars. Like going into work, I got to see people, I got to interact with patients. And so it actually uniquely was better when I was working, even though it was absolute mayhem in the ERs and on the labor floor. It was a really, at the beginning, those first 6 months were really crazy.
Yeah. And at the, during that time, like Michelle said, as residents, like we didn't, like other people were scared and they were like with their pods and their families and whatever, but like we couldn't expose other people to that because we were exposed to COVID all day, all night, whatever, as residents. But then we couldn't hang out with other people outside of work. But usually you couldn't hang out with your friends from work because they were at work because we time.
Yeah.
So it was like Michelle said, it was very isolating. And we were not interns. We were like second and third years and whatever. So then that also became part of it too, because interns are usually the people you send in first for non-acute issues so that they can learn and you can back them up. But for at that time, it wasn't worth the risk of exposing them.
Right.
So then as that more senior resident, you then had to do that job and you had to do your job because it didn't, if they did it, you'd still have to back check them anyway, right? So even those menial tasks that you would usually have like an intern do or like those low level things, they couldn't do them with the patient because it wasn't worth exposing them if you weren't able to rely on their judgment in the first place.
Right.
So it actually affected their training too. It also really affected their intern year's surgical training too. So it was just like a lot of...
That was a domino effect.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, even as attendings, I remember, you know, every single shift was like reworking her algorithm. You know, it started out like, have you been in Yonkers? You know, or first, have you been in China? Have you been in Yonkers? And then it was like, okay, well, that doesn't matter. Have you been, to the Bronx? Have you been, you know, and then it's like, yes, of course you've been to the Bronx. Do you live with six people? You know, like it was like, and she just kept this chart, this flow chart. It just literally, she's pouring over it every single day to update, you know, our flow, like our workflow. And then it was like donning and doffing and how do you get a patient for an emergency section from here to there? And then, you know, the patient, you know, that one patient who had to go to ECMO and everything, it was just like, it was every single day was like another like crazy, crazy thing. And then, you know, for me, I had two little babies, basically. I had a 5 and a 2-year-old, or three, I guess, 3 and 6, around there. Anyway, and I didn't want to go home. Like, I would go home and I would wear a mask, and it was like I didn't realize what it was doing to them. And so then I moved into a hotel room across the street over by the Marriott. I think it was the Marriott for a week.
Yeah.
I think one of the attendings actually gave me some weed to smoke to just like try to like chill. But you know, that's doing that alone is no fun. So
especially when you're like sad.
Yeah, I was really sad and I was really bored. And I remember I would go visit and I would like visit my kids from afar. And my daughter started stuttering and wetting the bed again. And my son, like they both just started regressing. And I was like, fuck this. So I didn't do that anymore. I went home. It was better to be at home and just like sort of.
I remember your risk fuck this it. Day when you were like, I'm going home. And I was like, hell yeah, you are.
Yeah. Like I don't even know if it lasted a week. I couldn't.
I feel like when we were residents, one of the things that just made me so mad was like, and I know that like our attendings cared about us and felt grateful for us, but I just felt like nobody cared about us. And like the amount of time and like effort and just everything that we sacrificed, I feel like sometimes just got very overshadowed. Like, you know, there were all these things like people were like, oh, like when you leave the hot, like we were getting emails from the hospital being like, try to sleep in another room, try to, you know, whatever. I'm like, I am on a resident salary in New York City and I live in a 400 square foot something apartment with my then fiance who like would not leave because I told him, I was like, go home, go stay with your parents in Pittsburgh. You'll be safer. And he's like, I'm not going to leave you here because who knows what's going to happen to you. And I would like come home and I would take my clothes off in the hallway outside of my apartment, decontaminate myself. Like I had different shoes that I was going in and out of the hospital that I would like change my clothes. Like I was doing everything in my power, but like, I just remember being so frustrated getting these emails being like, just sleep in a separate bedroom. I'm like, what separate bedroom? Like, I don't have a separate bedroom. I can't afford the apartment I live in with one bedroom that is not really a one bedroom. It's a studio with a little wall built in there. Like, you need to relax and you need to consider that maybe that's not realistic for people. And maybe like, you know, we were working in the Bronx and like all these other hospitals in New York, like Columbia and Cornell and NYU, like everybody was getting all these donations and the Bronx was getting shit because who cares? Like we're in, you know, the Bronx and nobody cared about us. And like, I just remember feeling like nobody cared except us, like in our place. And, you know, people were like trying to fundraise internally. Like I was like begging people on the internet for masks and like people like, kindness came, but it was just not the same. Like I remember seeing online, like the NYU people got like, I don't know, like some restaurant was donating meals to them every night. I was like, what the fuck? Like, what about us? Like, we're also in New York and like, we also need help. Like, you know, again, you don't do it for like, oh, I want a reward. It just felt like the isolation of not only like not being around your friends and family, not being able to tap into the other resources, other places we're getting. And nobody understood it except people that were going through it. Like seeing people that lived in other states or whatever that were like, oh, I don't believe in masks or whatever. And you'd be like, you just like, you don't get it. It was so isolating in such a way that like, I don't know. I've still never really forgiven the world for like what same. Happened.
Yeah. You poor thing. Like, I'm going to call you out, Rupal, because like, everybody else would be like triple layered and like all this stuff. And you'd walk onto the labor floor with your mask hanging off one ear.
I had COVID three times. Okay.
Rupal was done. Rupal was done with COVID after one
why
day.
Why do you think you got into
it? No, yeah, totally. But I had gotten, no, but I remember that timeline. Okay. I had gotten COVID the very first day before we even knew COVID was a problem. Like how Cappy and I got it that day.
Right. And when they had the one isolation bed in Jacoby and they were like, this should be good.
Yeah, they were, and then we were, then our patients all tested positive, and then we got it. Okay, so I had COVID, so I was like, oh, I'm immune, and because that's how diseases work, and so which like is partially true for a period of time. So I wasn't really that worried about it, and then yeah, eventually I stopped kind of triple masking, and you know what? I don't think it made much of a difference.
Well, like, I will say that, and truly. What you were saying to your point, Dr. Peskin, Dr. Nathan was amazing. I mean, the protocols were changing on a weekly basis. We were adapting. People were coming up with new medicine every week because we had never been exposed to it. But I mean, to Rupal's point also, with our patients, when there are people coming in we sometimes can't wait for a COVID test. If someone's 10 centimeters and delivering, we're not waiting for the COVID to come back. We're going in and we're delivering them. And like sometimes you didn't even have gloves and you just deliver them in the toilet. So it didn't, like, yes, you can be cautious and we were, but the patient care came first. And
or like the patient that needed emergent general and they got intubated and everyone's like, the worst thing that you could do is be in an intubated room with a COVID patient and no N95. And like, you'd be suturing, you'd be closing the skin. They'd be like, hey, their COVID test came back positive. You're like, well,
whoops,
that's great.
All right. Yeah, cool. No, I definitely was in that. I was in a room like that in the main OR when that definitely happened. Yeah. Do you guys remember the zap machine? Like all of a sudden they came
up. Yeah, you would just sit in there and like let it zap all your
clothes. Okay, that room needs to be zapped. Do you not remember this?
Oh, yeah.
The UV light. Are you serious?
No, it's if it did anything.
I remember that.
Of course it didn't do anything.
We'd like throw our masks and our shoes and everything.
And the cell phones? How many times?
I didn't do any of the things you're talking about. I was like,
okay. And like, I think the hospital thanked us by giving us like UV light things for our phones. Do you remember this? To clean our phones?
No, we probably didn't get that because we were residents.
Did not get that.
Yeah, it didn't matter.
Remember when they tried to not give us hazard pay because they said we weren't actually employed doctors?
I know.
And went into rooms. Yes. We put on garbage bags.
No, Yankees ponchos were the best thing. When they were like, here's Yankees ponchos for PPE. And then someone called it out. And they're like,
it went viral.
That was like, it was a gift. It wasn't for PPE. It was a gift. Yeah, it was Rachel. Good on her.
Yeah.
CNN was like, we need to talk to you. Yeah, that was
awesome. Oh, yeah.
I forgot about her.
Yeah, that was fun. I don't know. I mean, the world's so crazy now. I guess it was like a nice appetizer for like all the things we have to know and do now. But that was really kooky. That was a weird time to be a resident. I feel like, I don't know, in the residents I'm working with now, like you can see like in the trainees that of like that time that were either in medical school or junior residents, like it did affect things for everybody. We were all held back a couple years.
But I did feel very supported. While I felt isolated, I felt very supported by our, like,
our people were like,
maybe
yeah.
Not the hospital necessarily, like people who took care of us, they really had our backs. If shit hit the fan, like I wanted Dr. Banks in our corner, and she was like, she and our teams, like they were really supporting us through that time.
Yeah.
And to that point, kind of, we look to them obviously for like clinical stuff, but when you think about like Francine Hughes or Lisa Nathan, if they got scared, like you could see it in their eyes, like if they got scared about something, that's when you got really scared, because you're like, these are the two smartest, most capable women that exist, and if they are nervous, now I'm very nervous. And they were pouring in everything they could to try and figure out how we were going to do this, because no one had a protocol, right? Like they were literally inventing public health and like how we in real time, they were like, we don't have a guideline. We are literally going to figure this out. Yeah. And like, it's not like the work ended at work. We would then go home. They would then go home and then get on They would get on Zooms or whatever it was at the time with like 50 other people around the world and try and figure out like, what are we going to do for these patients? But like when they were scared, that is the thing that made me really nervous. Like, I remember watching Hughes. I remember, like, one time looking at Nathan and, like, you could just see, like, she had just been so overworked and, like, was so tired of everything. And, like, the hospital was kind of destroying her a bit. And I was like, okay, now I'm actually nervous. And watching Francine Hughes, because, like, she similarly had her family at home. And, like, I think she was taking care of her mom. But she was on the floor all the day because she knew that she didn't say this out loud, but she knew she's the smartest person. So she has to be in the hospital, because if something goes down, she needs to be there to take care of them. So like, I can't imagine having to deal with all that. At least if I died, I would have been doing it at home by myself.
And that's why he didn't wear a mask.
Yeah.
I did wear a mask. I did wear three masks.
He wore a mask. He wore a mask.
From our perspective, we were sort of forced into this emergency thing. And that, you know, and, but, you know, it's really important to hear your perspective, because I think that I wasn't, that's not where my mind was at all, to be honest. I was terrified. I just, you know, I was like on a sort of an adrenaline, sort of in adrenaline mode, like, okay, this is go time, you know, who knows what's going to happen. We just have to like deal with whatever. And it was a hard time to be compassionate to everybody and sort of take care of yourself. But I think that's like a bigger metaphor for being a doctor in general, you know, like how do you do that? How do you, especially now that you guys are out, you know, how do you take care of yourself and advocate for yourself and make sure you're happy, but also take care of the patients who are challenging and also take care of the trainees you're responsible for? You know, it's a lot. You're imperfect, you know, but it's, I think COVID kind of was like, it put a huge magnifying glass on that.
You did a pretty good job, though. I would say you would be included in that. It's not just because we're on the podcast, but you were in the certain, it's like a fact. Like, you were like such a meaningful attending to all of us, and you were in there with us. Like, there was nothing too beneath you to do. And that's how, that was also a relic of like old Montefiore, or like all of the attendings that were like that at one time, or most of them. It's like they would do it too. They would be right next to you doing all the work. So, you know, there was part of that. I know you're saying like you didn't really think of it that way, but I wouldn't put you in the group of people, or really most of our attendings in the group of people that didn't consider us at all.
Yeah, like, no, it was all right about our...
Yeah,
it was like all our group. Like, I just remember being like, if something happens to me, like, I know that there's going to be people who like care and know, and it's going to be all the people on this labor floor, all the people in this OR with me. Like, that's who's going to be there. That's who's going to care if something happens to me. I am not a pregnant woman. I'm not a woman that, you know, requires any of these services, but I know if I, like, that's who's going to end up taking care of me in this hospital. And I feel like that was like the only thing, like that, and, you know, having co-residents, like Cappy said, just to like, that was it. Those were, that was your support in that time. Because even like, if you, you know, I think the people that were even as close, the closest with their families, like, it's still, it was just something that you couldn't really explain to anybody, or people really couldn't understand what you were going through except the people who were in it with you. And I feel like everybody, like, that's who was like, hey, do you have a mask? Like, did you get a new N95 this week? Because I just got one and mine's still good. You know, I've had this one for only 2 days or 3 days or whatever. And I just remember like seeing attendings crying on the labor floor and being like, you need to go and sit down. Like, how often do you have that like reversal of roles? And that's just because like everyone was in it. We were all just one group, and that was huge. And I think it, you know, that feeling like lingered after, like that kind of strength and bond that you formed like in those ways. And I feel like, not, I'm not happy COVID happened, but like I do feel like I left my residency with like a very unique relationship with the people that I trained with, that I will not get any, there was no way you could get that in any other way.
6 in the morning, as soon as you walk through that door, everyone needs you again. The world's out of order. It's not a sound when you're not around. All day on your feet, hard to keep that energy. I know when it feels like the end of the road, you don't let go. You just press forward. You're the engine that makes all things go. Always in disguise, my hero. I see a light in the dark. Smile in my face when we all know it's hard. There's no way to ever pay you back.
it was like Monty always had that, and then they like injected it like steroids
during that time.
Because it is a magical place, like at baseline from a camaraderie standpoint. Like, yes, it's rough, and yes, you know, it's not the South with please and thank yous. Like, that's not really how we talk to each other there, but it was such a sense of like community, attendings, nurses, residents, and it is very different than what I hear from other people at different places. I think anyone who comes from Montefiore will go on and on and on about how it's like honestly a magical place in many ways. Like, we like to complain about it, and there's many things to complain about, but that COVID experience that Ariel just described, like, really put that on steroids. It was crazy.
Yeah, it exemplifies how much trust there was. And I think to your point, yes, residency and having attendings in general does that. But similarly, I've heard at various other places that it's not that same level of camaraderie. Yeah. And I have certainly texted people that maybe I haven't talked to in 5 years, and I would feel totally comfortable asking any of them for a curbside consult or their opinion, because it's just people who have a shared goal, and you just knew that. That's why you went there. That's why you chose it and worked there. Yeah. And that's what makes it so unique.
Oh, I miss it so much.
Yeah. Right? Right? I'm telling you, it's in your bones, in your blood. And every single person who I've had the pleasure and privilege of getting to, like, sort of go down memory lane with, right? Like, people who did residency in the 80s. And, you know, it's funny talking to Judy Levy, who, you know, started as a medical student, you know, 1980. Like, it's the same thing. It's the same, you know, same place, same craziness, but also that mission. That, like, internal mission that drove us to seek out that particular residency. And I know Rupal, you said, like, you don't really have a choice, but I don't know about you, but I mean, I ranked it first. I knew I wanted to be there. And,
oh, I ranked it number one too.
Yeah. So but you did.
Like, yeah,
but no, you did, because, like, you know, you knew that, and they knew that they felt that from you. And that's why we, you know, we went there. But
like,
it really,
like,
it's
a match kind of.
Other places don't have this same bond, COVID or not.
Yeah.
You know, if you read Mitch Maimon's book, Every Third Night, it is wild because he describes our residency, you know, like,
it's about Jacoby, right?
Well, it's about the Bronx, whatever that place was called. It was Einstein before it was Einstein.
Oh, okay.
It was the Bronx residency, but yeah. Yeah, it's really insane. Okay, that was, like, pretty sobering, and it brought back a lot of memories. I don't know why. Did I block it out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called PTSD.
Yeah.
Yeah. We all have that.
Yeah.
I can't watch, like, shows and shit about it. I just,
honestly,
like,
watching that show. What's that show? The Pit.
Yeah, I can't do it. Like, when he's having, like, the COVID flashbacks, I'm like, okay, same.
Right?
Yeah, because it was like that.
It was like that.
It was
100% like that.
It was,
I will say,
experiences of our lives. Like, I've not gone through something similar.
The OB, I don't know.
I hope never again.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you never know.
I don't know. Measles is coming back with a vengeance. I'm just, what? It is. It's knocking on the door. I don't know. I think those red spots could look really good, you know, like a little
Well, none of
complexion.
Us anymore, so hopefully it'll be less for us, we hope.
Yeah, we hope.
Yeah.
We hope. I don't know.
Oh my God, how to distill?
Oh, shit. Okay, wow. All right, positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm trying to think of, like, one that's worth mentioning on a podcast, because I have, like, so many, like, small little ones, but they're just, like, we did a shoulder. It was funny. We looked at each other in the eye. I mean, like, I actually have a funny one with Ariel, but and she knows which one I'm talking about. But
yeah, I know, because I remember that day clearly.
But I remember, like, looking at you and in the eye, just, like, while we're doing a shoulder and like couldn't get it, and it was like you look at me, you're like, okay, try again. Like looking at me like scared, and like we did get it, but like that's not fun good enough for a podcast. I can't really
I
remember.
think I would
I
say about
remember,
you.
yeah, no, go ahead, Kathy.
Okay. I would say about not a specific memory about you, Dr. Peskin, is that anytime we saw that you were on or were doing a case with you, we were confident, I think I can speak for all of us, that like it would always be okay. You were so thoughtful, so intelligent, not were, you are. So intelligent, and would challenge us. You know, we knew that you were evidence-based and thinking through things in a way that not many other people do, and that you care so deeply about the patients and their well-being that I always felt like I knew that it was gonna be okay when we were on together.
And you were going to learn something. Like you were
Yeah.
going to learn a completely different way to do a thing. The woman
Yeah.
trained at Montefiore. She had been an attending at Montefiore. She had been Monty, 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 Monty. Yet she had like 15 other ways of doing something that no one else knew how to do it that way. But you're like, where did you learn this? You were here the whole time.
And it
That.
needs a place like you because you are fine going against the grain. You are able to say, no, we're actually going to try for the next hour and a half for her to have a vaginal delivery because that's what's best for the patients. And I don't care if anyone else thinks that. I know that that's right. And if you don't agree with me, that's your problem. And we need
Yeah.
that. Like, that is
Yeah.
what is totally what's best for patients, and it's so admirable to see in a person because there aren't many people who are willing to go against the majority vote.
Know how I got like that. In my personal life, I'm completely not like that. I don't know. I think you guys probably remember growing from intern to chief and eventually getting, I mean, Rupal, maybe you started out that way, but anyway, like getting your confidence about you, and really every year you just like sort of build on that, build in that, build in that until you get to a point where you feel really comfortable and confident and you're pushing your own limits, right? And I don't, I started off, guys, I was like terrified. I didn't know what a cervix felt like. I didn't know how to round. I didn't know how to present. I didn't know. I messed up so many times, and I was called out for it, and I cried, and and it was like one after the other, and I just like, and if I found something I was good at, I would whether you know what I was really good at? I was really good at running the labs from the Jacobi triage down to the lab. I would get the labs and run the labs and get the labs and run the labs. And I was really, really, really good at that. And I would be like, jump down the stairs like four at a time. And I knew where all the blood bank was. That was what I was really, really, really good at. And so I did that really well. The other stuff I wasn't so great at. And like, and eventually I got better, but it was something that grew very organically. And then all of a sudden, somewhere in my third year, I don't know. I like something bloomed, something blossomed. And it was, and then once I got to my chief year, I really like, that's when I started reading about spinning babies. And I started reading like all these other like papers. Like I remember being in actually in FIGO, in Italy in 2012, I want to say. Is that right? Maybe. And I remember I had read a paper about the hysterotomy closure and that people weren't locking. And that was like a thing people were literally doing all over the world, except in America. And that it was, and that the single layer non-locking was better than a double layer or a single layer locking, which were both inferior to a at that time to a double layer, but we now know whatever, it doesn't matter. Point is I read this paper and I was like, holy cow, that's so cool. I would love to try that. But I was like nervous. I never did it until I went to Stony Brook and actually a former Einstein resident, Natalie Semenyuk, well, you know her.
You know her, yeah.
She I said it some one day. I was like, oh, well, they have this study and it says that a single layer, she goes, oh, I don't lock. I was like, you don't lock. And all that's all I needed. And then I was like, from then I was like, okay, well, I'm never locking again. You know what I mean? But like it was a total transition. So I don't know how I got there. It was very organic. And I'm sure it happens to you in your fields. I mean, you guys are brilliant. Like, where in your field, what do you test the limits, like, or anything like that? Like, do you challenge yourself in that way?
We have to get like really creative with chemo often. I feel like there's so many different regimens and there's so many different ways to treat something, and there none of these trials reconcile with each other, whether these chemos should be given with radiation or without radiation, or should you add on this immunotherapy, or should you add this? And like sometimes you're just kind of like putting them together in a way that isn't like, no one knows what is the exact way to do. So you kind of like within your institution, like at Montefiore or here or whatever, kind of you carve out your own lane, your own evidence way of doing something, because there's no head-to-head trial between these things to explain you should do this, 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 and you have to go where you think the data is pointing. And that can be a little bit different because different institutions have different cultures and protocols and perspectives ingrained into them based off of like their radiation culture, their preferred immunotherapy for this or that or whatever. And you know, those are things that I'm like seeing.
That's cool. Well, you should do that. You know, I would, if I had any advice for you guys, I would say, as long as you know what you're doing is not harmful, and if you even find someone who's brave enough to try it, you know, somewhere in some rinky dink, whatever, like corner of the world, and you're interested in that, and as long as you know you're not doing any harm, I would say go for it, try it, see how you like it. It may not be the wrong thing. You can test it out. And that's sort of what I did and what you saw from me. And I wasn't trying to be like iconoclastic or anything. I wasn't trying. I just was like curious. Because I had trained in the same place. I learned the exact same C-section that you guys learned. And I just didn't like it. And I wanted to do something else. And I wanted to see what else might be faster, helpful, whatever. And, you know, a C-section's so silly. But like, I think that there's room in medicine for you to like you're saying, Ripple, like carve your own path. I would encourage anybody in medicine, if I could tell you anything, is to try to like test, don't just copy what was done for millennia, like try to, you know, push the boundaries.
All of us, four of us are always in many people, and what the Bronx and Montefiore has taught us is always asking why, not just to do something because that's what the standard is, but to continue, and all of our fields need this, to continue questioning why it is people are doing something that way. Is it because that's how you learned? Is that the evidence? And to keep that curiosity is so necessary in all of our fields.
And you know, the cool part is our attendings knew why. Like, you could ask them and they would pimp you at the board, and they would pimp you in your, and the amount of like formal education we had was actually crazy, because you look at these other programs and
they don't have any of it.
That where you did like stats 47 times, and then you rounded at the board, and like Bernstein would be sitting on his thing there and be like, tell me about the mechanism of this thing, and that's why we give this medication, whatever. And then you would do it in clinic, and you do it here. It was like so much of that, because people were just like truly testing the holes of your knowledge and like why you know what you're doing. But it made you a better doctor, because then you would like ask those questions and you would learn about them, and your attendings knew why.
Right.
Yeah. I find now there's a lot of like, you know, starting at a place where like there was like a way people did things, like what Rupa was talking about. There's like a culture where you come. And like one of the things that like drives me crazy is like Foley management after surgery. I'm like very passionate about it. I want them out, but I want them out at the appropriate time, and urine's a vital sign, blah, blah, whatever. I don't know. Okay. And like trial of weight at night, like all these ways to troubleshoot, like it's just a stupid pee bag. So you just need to like learn how to like manage the pee bag. Okay. But like the residents will be like, well, this is the way Dr. Katcher does. I'm like, no. Right. This is the way that it works, because this is like human physiology. Like, this is how it works. Like, this is logical. This is not how I do it. This right. is just a logical way to do it. If you could tell me a more logical way to do it, we'll do it that way. But it's not like about like, oh, this is how I do it, and I just do it because there's no reason. You always have to be asking, like, why am I doing it? Does this make sense? Does it make sense for this patient? And if it doesn't, why am I doing it? Like, what's the point? Like, there's so many things that we in medicine do because that's just how we learned it, or that's just what we did. But when you go back and you look and you question all those things, like, there are a lot of gaps, unfortunately, especially in women's health, like, whether it's OB or gynonc or REI, whatever, there's a lot of gaps in what we know because we take care of understudy patients. We take care of women. So it's, as long as I agree with you, as long as you know you're not doing harm and what you're doing is reasonably within, you know, normal behavior, I don't know the best way to put it, you know, it's okay. As long as you can explain it, you can explain it to the patient, you can explain it to yourself. And I think that that's like a really important thing that you learn in a place like where we did residency, where you're constantly asked, like, why are you doing right. that? What's your reasoning for doing that? It's not like, what did you do? Why did you do that? It's why did you do it? Because what were you thinking when you did it? Not because right. you're in trouble. And I think, you know, the memories I have of you, Dr. Peskin, are of like good things, but the less good things were like 2 a.m. when you were like bopping around, like, oh, like what phase of labor is she in? What's going on? And I'm like already matched in gynonc. And I'm like, please stop. Like, and you're like, get the peanut ball. We're going to like put her on her side and like the peanut ball. And I'm like, oh my God. I will do it. Yeah. The peanut ball, that is synonymous. To you. Oh yeah. What's that?
Picking the apples.
Yeah. All that stuff you taught us that I never hope to use again. No. But like all of that, like that excitement for those things, that's my memories of you. And like whether I wanted them or not at 2 a.m., I was getting a lesson on the peanut ball, you know? And like you'd be like, oh, did you put the patient on the peanut ball? I'd be like, yep. And then you go in and you'd be like, I had to readjust it. It wasn't right. And I'd have to go in and I'd have to look at it because I wanted to make sure it was right, because it was like instilled in us. Like, it was like, I have to know how to do it now, so I know for next time. And like that level of the self, like the self motivating, that I think is what, that to me is the thing that's the most special about where we trained. And that's the thing I look the most for, like when I work with a trainee, is like, how motivated are they on the inside to learn how to do this right? How much do they care about learning how to do this right, and why it's the right way to do it? And like, when you meet someone like that, like you're like, I know they're going to be a good doctor. They're going to be fine no matter what they do, because they have that hunger for the knowledge. When you meet someone who's just going through the motions, like you can tell, and it affects the learning significantly.
God, that I think is that's true. That is so true. Like,
I was like, you, I don't know. I can't think of really many people that we did residency with that weren't like that. That like everyone was kind of like that. Most of them.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority. Yeah. Maybe not about everything, but about most things. I do think.
I got to get Alexa one on this podcast, because she was ever like that. Like, Alexa.
Yeah. Why? Why?
Yeah, right. Oh, I've never met somebody.
You won't be able to finish your podcast. She's just gonna, yeah. She's gonna ask you 47 questions,
yeah. questions,
and none yeah. of them will have the answer. Like, you'll start, and she'll be like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah,
totally.
The most inquisitive person I've ever met, in the best ever. Way.
And like, some of the questions are personal. Like, all of a sudden, you're like, wait, Alexa, did you really ask yeah. that?
Yeah,
yeah. And how was that relationship with your mom? Like, how was that for you? Like, was that hard? Like, you know, like she'd get in there and you'd be like, we were literally talking about misoprostol. Like, what's going on? Yeah, she's great. Oh, I had such a good class. That was the best. I'm sorry. Like, you guys are great, but like, I had the best class.
It's okay. We don't necessarily agree.
Everyone was awesome in my class. All women. All wonderful.
Everyone was great in their own
way. All stars shine in their own way.
Do you guys still like keep in touch?
Yeah.
I mean, I talk to RuPaul every week.
Yeah, I talk to Cappy all the time.
Aw. I still have, I have a text message group with six of us. And it's the most irreverent text chain you will ever read in your entire life. You know, we graduated in 2012, and it is sometimes I'll wake up with like 135 messages. And yeah, it's just like it's amazing. It like really is like just brings you back to earth, and everybody's obviously doing their own thing, different parts of the country, and we just still all connect in such a basic, fundamental way, and it's just entirely because we trained together. I mean, it's just such a formative time in your life, and it's crazy because not everybody gets that in their 20s. Right. I mean, was that in your 20s or 30s? I guess 20s. I was in my 30s.
You were
or early, late 20s. 30 or early 30s. I mean,
I was late 20s, I guess.
Late 20s.
Yeah. I mean, our WhatsApp, we still like talk, but we've entered this now weird phase of like, we talk about our residents, like going to interview with other people, and they'll be like, oh, I met your co-resident, and now like I was telling her about my attending, and that's you. And like I was in the OR this week, and like, our resident's applying for MFM, and she was talking with Celia Moser, who was in my class, who's an MFM attending, and she's like, yeah, she said she knew you. And I was like, that's so weird. Like, it's so weird.
Well, it's
how
so,
time works.
But it's so special to have a built-in referral
totally
within our past attendings and past co-residents. There, within every subspecialty, you have someone that you can curbside and refer to, and it's amazing to have that community still.
Totally.
It's a huge network.
Massive. Every single meeting is some huge Einstein reunion, and I think I know somebody in almost every single state. So no matter where someone goes, I'm like, just let me know, because I, you know, for better or for worse, I think I know them. You know, I know somebody there. Yeah. And it's wild because like a lot of people will, you know, still text me and be like, what do you think of this fellow applicant? You know,
we did
yeah.
that.
You do that. Yeah.
You and I did that.
We did that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a small world. I feel like if any trainees are going to listen to this podcast, just know it's a really small world. You think it isn't, but it is. And you gotta be really, before you burn a bridge, you really got to be definitive about burning that bridge. I would highly recommend not. Because
well,
you
and
never
on the flip
know when
side,
people are going to come back around.
But on the flip side, you also have people who will.
Yeah, you have a million people in your corner.
Fight tooth and nail for you and know and can speak to how good of a person and physician you are, and that you'll be able to utilize them in any phase of your life. And
yeah,
it's amazing to have that.
Yeah, if you like, I don't know, I just can't like really imagine working in a place where you couldn't like rely on texting or calling or whatever you need to do to like talk to someone and be like, hey, I have a question about this, whatever. Like, I feel like every job, I mean, you know, again, I've done two matches and now look for a job, like a real job, like a real person. And like every time I still, you know, was like, can I imagine calling this person at like 11 PM being like, what do I do? And if the answer is no, like, I don't know. I don't know what you're doing there. I don't get that. And there were places I interviewed for jobs where I was like, no, vibes are off. Like, you don't seem cool. You don't seem like someone I could do that. And I feel like, again, that starts in your training. You know, how you see your attendings act with each other is going to influence how you decide you're going to be in your practice in the future. So if you train a place where people are not collaborative and don't work together, that's what you're going to learn. And you're going to be like that the rest of your career, probably. I think like we all have met people who are like, why are you like that? Like, why are you the way that you are? Like, who hurt you? And it's like, I think it starts early. Like, they're just around people and train with people that don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys have all spoken to the point that, you know, we were a really big community. And, you know, I think Rupal mentioned all of the million conferences and, you know, and you guys were saying, like, you know, asking why this doesn't happen everywhere. And this, you know, I think that's been a hallmark of Einstein Montefiore for quite a while. I mean, I don't know that it was always like that. But certainly, I think ever since Dr. Mercatz came and then like the implementation, I mean, we had Shazat rounds and Tijani rounds and Goldberg rounds before you guys got there. We had all of these rounds that were sort of then morphed into the rounds that you guys are familiar with. But all of that was like, you know, and then at the board, a very, you know, comfortable environment to be like, well, why did you do that? And be able to actually say that to somebody. You know, okay, comfortable, but like we're, you know, but at other hospitals, I'm not going to name names, but at other hospitals, it's not okay to be like, why did you do that? Like, what were you thinking? You know, I mean, it's you can say it nicer than more nicely than that, but like, you know, to at least challenge people and ask them and, you know, learn a lot, like across the board, but you know, that all feeds into how you guys became the physicians you are now and, you know, and how you're going to help your patients. Cause when your patients ask you something, you'll be able to, you know, not get defensive about it or be like, cause I said so, you know, you'll be like, okay, well, I'm happy to like explain to you why the Foley needs to come out at X, Y. You know, it's funny. Arielle, you like talking about that. You're going to be like to the residents, you will always now be known as like the Foley person. Oh, yeah. Like that crazy, is your reputation. Just like I am the peanut ball person that you guys will never, you'll never be able to dissociate from me from the peanut ball.
Yeah.
I am happy to say like, that the NYU nurses do all the peanut balls. I don't have to say a word that was there before I got there. So yeah. So I am no longer the peanut ball person at NYU. I am other, I have other nicknames, I'm sure. But whatever. Yeah. I don't give a
fuck. I like, you know, there's worse things to be known for. I just.
Rupal, yeah, what kind of reputation do you want?
Well, I don't care.
I've already talked you up.
Oh, well, that they're in.
I was like, you're going to love him. He's like adorable and funny and also really sassy.
I mean, I'm a little bit intense with residents, I think. We'll see.
I love it. Somebody needs to be more intense than me. So you can do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think like we're going to have a good relationship. And if we're just going to have a direct relationship. And I think I appreciated that with my attendings. Like, you know, the most formative individual for me is Dr. Kuo, like in my education and training and how I want to be and how I think about medicine. And he didn't do it with a smile. I'm not saying that I'm going to emulate that on my own person and I'm much more smiley than Kuo. But I appreciated that because it was direct and it was clear and there was a reason and it was founded primarily in the patient, like, and her outcome, and then secondarily in my education. So I'm going to mirror that
because and he could back it up with the skill and
yeah,
and like the, you know, there was nothing that he really couldn't do.
But his like particularities, like I'm a particular person. I think it's kind of like Arielle was talking about with the Foley, whatever. Like, I have my things that I'm very particular about and there's reasons and I will let people know that and let them know when I'm disappointed.
I'm like that too, obviously. I'm okay with it. Honestly, they can learn there from a million other people and then they can learn the way I do something and they can figure out what they like when they leave. And I think that that's important.
That's how you do it, right? You're just like
that's a whole point.
Conglomeration of all the people that came before you. You pick and choose the things that you liked and you didn't like. And, you know, you do these things because you're like, this makes sense to me. This doesn't make sense to me. But you have this whole armamentarium. Dr. Kuo taught me that word. Things that you can do when you need them and they're there for you when you need them and then you put them back away when you never want to think of them again, but it's there and that's how you do it. And so, like, you know, being particular again, you know, when you're a trainee, this isn't, again, I genuinely believe like there is no one that cares the way that a resident cares about patients and everything. But when you're a trainee, you're very in it because you are overworked, you are underpaid, you are exhausted, and there's a lot of other stuff going on. And it's very complex. And we could spend a whole 2 hours just talking about that and why that's all messed up. But you get very in it and you get very into yourself and your needs. And again, it's very important to recenter and focus around why we're doing what we're doing. It's about the patient and caring for the patient. And at the end of the day, like that's what has to come first. So being direct, like Rupal said, like you have to be very direct sometimes because sometimes you do mess up and you say, you have to say that's not okay. You don't have to belittle someone and make them cry and make them feel horrible, but you do have to make sure that they understand that this was not right, but there's a way to fix it and a way to improve. And that's how you do it. And I think the opposite is true. Like, I think sometimes one thing that Monty wasn't great at all the time was telling you when you were doing a good job at something, right? Like it's very easy to tell someone when they're doing something wrong. Sometimes doing something right, again, you don't need a cookie, you don't need a pat on the back, but if you don't know always what you do right, then you may not know when to reproduce that behavior or when to work, like push that more, go into that more. And so I think being direct about this went well or this did not go well is very important both ways. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that in a way too that's like not super like, wow, great job, everybody. Like, let's give ourselves a pat on the back. Because again, it's not really what it's about, but it's also important to be like, this, I think, went very well. And I need to see you do more of that too.
I was a third year at Montefiore North when Erica Levy had to give me a pep talk. And she's like, I remember we went into that atrium area. Did you guys ever go there? There's like a... I never went there. This was like one of the first times I ever, and she sat me down in that big room in a chair and she was like, Melissa, this place is not about making friends. It's about becoming the best doctor that you could be. It's not a popularity contest. It's not anything other than you becoming the best doctor that you can. So, yep. And that was it. And I literally was like, oh, okay. And she was, you know, she's actually a year younger than me. We went to the same college. She was a year behind me, but she's a year ahead of me in residency. And, you know, she's like also wise beyond her years. So one of my best friends, but she's, that was like really helpful. And I don't know that young people are listening to this, but I do think that you have to remember that were there for the patients. And that was something that always sort of was like at the center. I hope that's what came across from you guys. It was never really personal so much. It was more that I just wanted, that I just wanted what was best. I don't know. I know that that's what you want.
Yeah. I had a senior resident that this is not good advice or good behavior, but I had a senior resident tell me one time, I don't know what happened, and I'm not a big crier, never was, never have been, but something happened and I cried at work, which was like a rarity. And I was a junior resident, and she's like, you really shouldn't cry. There's going to be worse things that happen to cry about. And I was like, what the fuck? But she, you know, she was right. There were worse things. And what it was in the moment wasn't a big thing. And it, you know, again, we should be validating people's feelings and supporting and making space. And I do believe all of that. But at the end of the day, like,
I don't believe in all that. I get so frustrated.
Yeah. But like, you know, it was one of those things where like, she was right. Like worse things did happen and I didn't break down and I didn't cry and I learned a way to move on. And I think like that those like, again, like just bringing it back to the patient. And when you have those, like, I think you asked us earlier, like what, you know, like when you have those hard times or those hard days or whatever it is, like you have to kind of like remind yourself why you do it. That's been a big lesson for me this year is like, why did I choose this career? Not because I regret it, but just like to remember like on those days that were hard or like, when you're just like, why is everything so difficult? Like, why are all these patients so complex? Like, why, you know, you kind of just have to be like, there is a reason, like when it comes back to it, and you get these patients or you get these interactions with the resident or something that you're like, oh, that's why. That's it right there. And there's no other place or no other thing I'd rather do. It's not every day, but it's a lot of days.
That's a good, I think, segue. We're going to probably wrap it up. I think RuPaul has to go and
take care of
a patient, right?
Wow.
Oh.
I'm just on call. It's not my patient, but yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
But yeah. I want to thank you all. You guys are so amazing. I'm so proud of you. I think I met you. I think RuPaul and Cappy, you were in the middle of your first year when I met you. And same Ariel in the middle of your second year. And I couldn't be more privileged to have been part of your training because you guys are really outstanding and you made work really fun. I actually really, as much as even if you're lying and about being happy that I was on call, I actually really, really looked forward to being on call with you.
Great. I love being on call with all of you. I mean, it's like, and I agree with Catcher. When I think back on our residency, it's what stands out isn't the long days and the long nights, and there were definitely plenty of those, but we all, I think, had the feeling of being a part of something that was bigger than us, and it was physically and emotionally and mentally demanding in every way. But those were the moments where we all learned the most about empathy and about resilience and what it truly means to care for people at their most vulnerable. And I'm honored to know all of you and all the people we worked with. And it was an unforgettable experience and I think shaped us into who we are as physicians. So I loved being on call with all of you, truly.
And I can't follow that up, so I will say goodbye. All right. Love you guys.
Wouldn't change a thing.
See you later.
Thank you guys again. Have a great night.
Bye.
Bye.